Welcome back or to the Sleep Research Society podcast. My name is Jesse Cook, and I serve as host of the Sleep Research Society podcast, which is purposed to disseminate and discuss the latest findings in sleep and circadian science. Before diving into today's episode, it is critical for me to emphasize that the views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individual being interviewed and do not reflect the views of the Sleep Research Society or its affiliates. Also, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice. If you believe you have a medical problem, please speak with your doctor. Sleep health plays a critical role in short and long-term health outcomes. A wealth of existing epidemiological research establishes an undeniable association between an individual's average sleep duration with mortality risk, using both subjective and objective measures. Complementary research has identified and solidified the important relationship between average sleep duration and specific health issues, such as cardiometabolic problems and cancer. This robust literature has helped guide current sleep health guidelines with a principal focus on recommendations for average sleep duration, such as the guidance of 7 to 9 hours of sleep for young to middle-aged adults. However, sleep duration is only one dimension of sleep health, albeit clearly an important one. Sleep regularity, defined as the day-to-day consistency of sleep-wake timing, is another dimension of sleep health that has been shown to have an important relationship with overall health. Notably, recent research has evidenced sleep regularity as a stronger predictor than sleep duration for specific health outcomes. For example, the findings from Lunsford, Avery, and colleagues highlighted a stronger relationship between sleep regularity and cardiometabolic outcomes relative to that observed with sleep duration. Additionally, Trivedi and colleagues found that sleep regularity was a greater predictor of quality of life in post-treatment cancer patients relative to all other actigraphically captured sleep metrics, including sleep duration. As such, there is growing evidence highlighting the unique independent import of sleep regularity for health outcomes, with future work necessary and useful for progressing and evolving sleep health guidelines. Although previous research has associated subjectively captured sleep regularity with mortality risk, this relationship has not been previously explored using objective tools. In this episode, I am joined by Dr. Andrew Phillips and Daniel Windred to discuss their recent publication in the journal Sleep, entitled Sleep Regularity is a Stronger Predictor of Mortality Risk Than Sleep Duration, a Prospective Cohort Study, which was focally designed to address this gap in knowledge by using objective sleep data collected in a large cohort to assess the relationship between sleep regularity with risk for all-cause mortality and mortality from cardiometabolic causes and cancer. Additionally, the study sought to evaluate whether sleep regularity was a stronger predictor of mortality risk than sleep duration. Before diving into the interview portion of today's episode, here is a brief background on today's guests, Dr. Andrew Phillips and Daniel Windred. Dr. Andrew Phillips is an associate professor at Monash University within the Turner Institute for Brain and Mental Health in the School of Psychological Sciences. Dr. Phillips completed a PhD in physics at the University of Sydney in 2009. He then began a postdoc in neurology in the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital of Harvard Medical School. His research vision is to understand the physiology and functions of circadian rhythms in sleep with three main areas of focus. 1, the importance of sleep regularity for human health. 2, the sensitivity of the human circadian system to light. And 3, the development of physiological models for predicting circadian timing, sleep, and alertness. He has developed mathematical models and health-based metrics that are widely used in the sleep and circadian fields, including the Sleep Regularity Index, or SRI, which is the focus of today's episode. Notably, he has also made fundamental discoveries about the circadian system, including inter-individual differences in sensitivity to light. Daniel Windred is a PhD candidate at Monash University, working under Dr. Andrew Phillips. He holds a Bachelor of Engineering and Bachelor of Psychology and brings an interdisciplinary approach to sleep and circadian research. Daniel's work focuses on circadian disruption. His research interests include assessing sleep regularity, utilizing computational models to capture the response of the human circadian system to light, and developing open source software for analyzing sleep patterns from wearable devices. Daniel's work characterizes relationships between circadian disruption and common health outcomes, with a primary focus on cardiometabolic health. He is passionate about generating research that translates into simple and accessible public health recommendations. So without further ado, here is my interview with Dr. Andrew Phillips and Daniel Windred, unpacking their recent publication in the journal Sleep, entitled Sleep Regularity is a Stronger Predictor of Mortality Risk Than Sleep Duration, a Prospective Cohort Study. I hope you enjoy. Dr. Andrew Phillips and soon-to-be Dr. Daniel Windred, welcome to the Sleep Research Society podcast. I must say, it's a true pleasure having both of you join me today to discuss your research, and I do really appreciate you finding the time for this interview. It is kind of weird because we're on different days of the week, given where we are located geographically, and that always blows my mind. But somehow we won the time zone battle and landed on an appropriate time. So cheers to all of us. Before we go into anything related to this amazing manuscript, I must ask, Andrew, how are you doing today?
Doing very well. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Outstanding. It's a pleasure to have you. And Dan, how are you doing?
Also doing really well, thanks. Excited to be here and talking about sleep and circadian rhythms with you guys.
What gets better than talking about sleep and circadian rhythms? It truly warms my heart, and I'm really looking forward to this interview. Now, Andrew, Dan, I've given the listeners an introduction to your background, and thank you both for sending over those biographies. It really helps us out. But I always find it beneficial, you know, the listeners really appreciate it, if you could tell a little bit more about yourself. So we'll start with a couple orientation questions here. Dan, we'll start with you. Can you please tell us about your journey to sleep and circadian research at this point?
Yeah, so I have a background in both engineering and psychology. That was sort of my undergraduate studies. And that's sort of what led me into sleep and circadian rhythms. And the work I do, I feel like, has some sort of natural overlap. I'm really interested in the idea that we can understand the human circadian system as a dynamic system, something that we can describe mathematically. And the benefit of understanding this system is that we can then make recommendations for people that lead to better health and well-being outcomes. So yeah, I started my honors with Andrew in 2019, and he really impressed upon me how little we know in a lot of areas of circadian rhythm research. And here I am 5 years later, still working with Andrew and about to submit my PhD thesis next week.
Soon to be Dr. Dan. And yeah, I echo so many of those sentiments. I mean, it was Michael Grandner earlier on this podcast, maybe like 10 plus episodes ago, talking about how this is going to be the new decade of circadian health. And I truly believe that. So I'm excited to have you both on to continue amplifying this discussion. Andrew, can you outdo Dan here with your journey to sleep and circadian research at this point?
Sure. I don't know if there is a conventional path into sleep research, but I think mine was a little bit unconventional. I was a physics undergraduate, and I had a horrible commute for the first 2 years of my undergrad. I was getting up at 4:30 every morning. And I thought, there has to be some way to eliminate sleep. You know, we don't need this anymore. We've got to get rid of it. So that was actually what spurred my first interest in sleep. I thought, well, I'm going to research the topic, find an advisor who can help me to do some sleep research. And I very quickly realized that my lofty ambition of eliminating sleep was not going to be realized. Even if we found some way maybe to compensate for the memory consolidation aspect of sleep, we wouldn't be fixing the immunity effects or the effects on metabolism. So that wasn't going to work out. But I did get the bug. I got absolutely fascinated with sleep and circadian rhythms research. As Dan said, just so many open questions. You know, when I was starting in the field, so many open questions, and still today. And so I went and I did my PhD with Peter Robinson at Sydney University. During that, I developed basically a mathematical description of the circuitry in the brain that regulates sleep and wake patterns. That model's been used in lots of different industry and academic applications since then. I think the most important insight that came out of that work was that the same circuitry could explain how all kinds of different mammals slept. There was something fundamental about this idea of a sleep-wake switch. I went from there to go and do a postdoc with Beth Klerman and also Chuck Seisler as a mentor at Harvard Medical School. And I now have my own group back in Australia. And I'd say over time, my work sort of migrated from just being quantitative research and development of metrics and models into a more sort of empirical lab. So these days I have sort of a joint lab where it's both the development of quantitative insights and also field and lab-based data collection.
Remarkable. And I am now beyond words impressed and equally intimidated, and probably will do the listeners a favor and just shut up the rest of the episode and allow you to talk and steer the entire podcast. How does that sound?
No, thank you.
All right, fair. Well, instead, Andrew, I'll toss you this question. I've actually been pleasantly surprised that guests have the time for hobbies and interests outside of their research vocation and passion. So I must ask you, when you're not doing all these amazing, remarkable, brilliant contributions and advancements on the frontier of sleep and circadian research, what do you do in your spare time?
It's quite a mix of things. I have a fairly short attention span. I like reading. I like spending lots of time with my family. I play a lot of chess. I like to paint. I like to swim. I bounce around a bit.
Well, challenge accepted. I also do fancy myself as a bit of a chess player. We'll have to post hoc schedule a battle or something. And Dan, how about yourself? When you're not crushing the graduate school life and accomplishing a doctoral degree, what do you like to do in your spare time?
Yeah, so most of my spare time revolves around music. Lately, I've been spending a whole lot of time playing around with DJ decks, and I find it like a really interesting and sort of engaging way to discover new music and play around with it. I'm also a guitarist as well. I've done that for pretty much all my life. So I play acoustic guitar and I sing. I find it a really good way to wind down, I suppose. Yes, that's most of what I do in my spare time, really.
Very cool. And I have a sense how you may answer this, but perhaps I'll be completely surprised. But Dan, when you were a child, what did you aspire to be when you grew up?
Seems like you might have the right sense, a musician. So yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to be. I was out busking on the streets when I was like 12, 13, sort of earned all my pocket money that way. And so I sort of always wanted to do that up until sort of my late teenage years, at which point I think I realized that it was potentially like a stressful and unstable way to make a living. But then I sort of had the realization that now I've ended up in research and it's also somewhat unstable and stressful as well. So not sure I made the right choice.
It's good to know though, Dan, you know, if we run out of grant funding, we've got a backup plan.
Right, exactly.
Absolutely. And there's just so much commonality, I think, between music and science, from like the application of different thinking patterns, creativity, exploration, and precision. And I've seen a lot of harmony, if you will, between responses to that question, or at least the hobbies question from guests, where they generally do have some sort of musical background. So I now am going to employ you, as I have for other guests, free of compensation, to provide an updated SRS podcast soundtrack at some point. So thank you for stepping forward, Dan, to provide that. Andrew, what did you aspire to be when you were a child?
Yeah, I would say science wasn't really on the radar for me, at least until high school. And I had some sort of inspirational teachers at the high school level. As a kid, I was much more interested in being a writer or some sort of artist or possibly a racing driver.
Ooh, very cool. And if you weren't a sleep and circadian researcher at this point, then what career would you choose?
I think I would have gone my default path. I would have gone into theoretical physics. So I'd probably be, maybe that's cheating in answering a question, but I think I would still be a researcher, just in a different field. I can't get away from data.
I give you partial credit. Dan, do I even need to ask?
Yeah. I'm not sure that I would be a musician. I think I'd do something way more relaxing. So the thing I have in mind is I'm going to move to a tropical island. I'm going to be a scuba diving instructor. I'm going to own my own scuba diving school and just chill out.
I can get on board with that. And once I get burnt out, I'll come join you. And to tie it back to a common theme from past episodes, shout out to Angus Burns and Jackie Lane for the whales. And if you don't know what that means, go back and listen to their episode, but we're tying it back to the whales. All right, that's fun. We've done a nice job kind of setting our stage here with our orientation, and we'll go with a little transition here to science, since this is a Sleep Research Society podcast. And we're going to play a little keyword association. And gentlemen, in this segment, what we're going to do is I'm going to say some phrases and I'll pass back and forth between each of you. And I would like for you to respond with the first thing that comes to mind. It could be anything. It could be a single word. It could be a long-winded soapbox. The kingdom is yours. Dan, Andrew, are you ready for the keyword association?
I'm ready.
Ready as I'll ever be.
All right. Dan, we'll start with you. When I say sleep and circadian health, what comes to mind?
So the first thing that comes to mind is human health in general. I think there are very few aspects of human health that sleep and circadian rhythms don't touch. You have cardiometabolic diseases, cancer, mental health, neurodegenerative disorders. There's a whole host of human health outcomes that are potentially linked to sleep and circadian rhythms. So that's what comes to mind.
Beautiful. And Andrew, when I say sleep, wake irregularity, what comes to mind?
Many things. Probably the top one would be sight gapers. You know, when I think of why sleep regularity matters, I think of the circadian clock. I think, you know, really what we're seeing when people have irregular schedules is a marker of the fact that they also have irregular light patterns, irregular other inputs to the clock. And that's why we're seeing all of these downstream relationships.
Beautifully said. And I know it's not a focal component of today's episode, but I would love to pick your brain at some point, Andrew, on the light sensitivity aspect of your research body that you've done, because I find it so critically important to look at the inter-individual differences in light sensitivity when we start thinking about clinical modifications and adjustments. And yet we really haven't distilled it down in any capacity to that point, still very high level. And I think we're missing the boat there. So I'd love to pick your brain on that another time. But Dan, passing it back to you. When I say open source research tools, what comes to mind?
So actigraphy, first and foremost, but also valuable and underutilized, I would say. I think a lot of sleep measures of actigraphy historically have been derived from other proprietary software. And so I think we're sort of in a bit of a transition period where we're moving more towards open source tools. But I think it's, yeah, definitely sort of like a valuable avenue that we're moving more towards these days.
It's definitely worth a broader discussion in the future, because I actually have met a lot of researchers on the other side of the fence that are kind of against the open source movement, just because of the amount of effort that goes into creating packages, updating packages, and then other people leveraging it. But that's also not why we became scientists in the first place, right? But obviously there's academic positions, progression, things like that tied to it. It's a very complicated landscape, but I appreciate your dedication to it. And I imagine we'll talk about it more later. And last one here, Andrew, to land the keyword association. When I say shift work and health, what comes to mind?
My first thought is, how do we compare, measure, and optimize shift work schedules? In other words, which schedule is better than another schedule? And that's obviously going to be an individual question. You know, as you said, an individual's light sensitivity, other individual differences in physiology are going to play a role there. But I think that's a key question going forward, because I think what we're learning is that irregular sleep is a problem. How do we deal with that for this large portion of the workforce who essentially have irregular schedules imposed upon them?
Now, well said. Much work to be done on that front. All right. Great work there in our keyword association. And now I think we're ready for flight here. So as I mentioned in the introduction, today's episode focuses specifically on a recent investigation that you and your colleagues published in Sleep, which is entitled Sleep Regularity is a Stronger Predictor of Mortality Risk Than Sleep Duration, a Prospective Cohort Study. What a provocative title. Initially, I'm going to ask Andrew and Dan to provide a 10,000 foot view of the investigation, and then we'll dive a little bit deeper into the weeds of the methodology, findings, and implications. So I'll open this up to whoever wants to start the discussion, thinking about why you did this research. What fueled you to perform this research?
Yeah, so this particular study was part of a broader vein of sleep regularity research work that we've been doing. I think we're really entering the age of sleep regularity now. We're beginning to appreciate how important it is. And that's opening up a whole lot of questions, you know, in terms of understanding, well, what does sleep regularity predict? Why is it important? If so, what can we do about it? And that was really the motivation for this research. It was on this background of, well, we're finding more and more over the past few years that sleep regularity is this important predictor. Why don't we look at it in the biggest data set that we can with respect to arguably the most important outcome that we can, how long you live, and see how it performs there. And for a while now, I've been sort of having this suspicion that sleep regularity is potentially more important than sleep duration for our health. Now, we can argue what we mean by more important there. I am potentially being provocative, but it is something I believe. And the more evidence I see, you know, the more that we look into these data sets, it just seems to keep consistently coming out that sleep regularity is an incredibly important and until recently relatively overlooked predictor of our health. So that was really our sort of key motivation going into this was, firstly, how does sleep regularity predict mortality when we look at a large data set such as this? And secondly, how does it compare to sleep duration? Because obviously there's a wealth of research on sleep duration and mortality. We all know very well, the public knows very well, that how long you sleep is important for your long-term health and your longevity. And so we thought it would be interesting in this context to sort of pit the two directly against one another.
I love it. And it definitely aligns with a lot of my biases too that I'm carrying into this episode. So I will acknowledge that. I will often emphasize maintaining a consistent rise time as probably the most fundamental aspect of sleep health recommendations we can provide that doesn't put so much pressure on yourself for the bedtime portion, but ultimately probably sets you up for consistent sleep duration that is of sufficient duration as well. And so if you can tap into the regularity component, you're probably going to enhance the other dimensions of sleep health as well. So I loved the emphasis here. And I think that probably is an underpinning to your presumption of the importance of sleep regularity as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a big part of the motivation here is circadian. What we're saying here is the importance is not just how long you're sleeping, but that it's at an appropriate circadian time, right? We know that the quality of sleep is affected by when we're sleeping in our circadian cycle. And furthermore, when we're sleeping determines a whole bunch of other behaviors. It determines when we get exercise, when we eat, when we're exposed to light. So sleep in a way is a gate for other zeitgebers into the system. And if we're not keeping our sleep regular, we're going to affect all of that clockwork throughout the body. And so it's natural from that perspective that you would expect the regular sleep to associate with a very broad range of outcomes, given the fundamental role of circadian clocks in virtually all of our physiology.
Beautiful. And at the core of this is let's leverage our biology to be an ally towards our health outcomes and our sleep-wake patterns here. Excellent. And so we got the kind of background and rationale, and I heard a little bit about it already as far as the overall purpose of the particular investigation. So did you approach this investigation with any specific hypotheses? I kind of heard them, but maybe flesh them out a little bit more.
Yeah, I'd say there were two main ones that we came in with. One was simply that a regular sleep would be predictive of higher mortality risk. And we thought that would hold up even if we did adjust for obvious confounds for that. We felt that sleep regularity is likely to have a causal relationship with mortality. You know, while we can't establish causality from this study, that was sort of our underlying hypothesis. And secondarily, we believe that sleep regularity may actually be a more important predictor than sleep duration, or a stronger predictor when put head to head.
Outstanding. Perhaps we'll transition then to the actual methodology here. And again, we can stay high level here. We can steer people back to the manuscript. Yes, listeners, go read the manuscript. But whoever wants to take this one, can you please describe the design and the related methodology utilized in this investigation?
Yeah, so happy to take that one. We used data from the UK Biobank prospective cohort. So basically, it's a large scale data set, health related information in 500,000 individuals collected between 2006 and present day, and an older cohort, so 40 plus. And we had a sample of accelerometer data in 60,000 people. They wore an Activity AX3 accelerometer for 1 week each. We used this accelerometer data to derive estimates of sleep wake using GGIR, which is an open source R package for sleep wake estimation that has been validated against PSG, so gold standard sleep measure. And from this sleep wake data, we then calculated sleep regularity index scores. And we also derived an estimate of average daily sleep duration. So sleep regularity, sleep duration from accelerometry were our two exposure variables. And then our outcome variable was mortality, which was collected across an approximate 6-year follow-up period after the sleep measures. And that was collected through the NHS. So we ran some survival analyses to assess whether sleep duration and sleep regularity exposures were associated with subsequent mortality cases. So we ran three models. Firstly, does sleep regularity predict mortality? Secondly, does sleep duration predict mortality? And then thirdly, do sleep duration and sleep regularity together predict mortality? So we compare and contrast those models to figure out the relative contributions and which of regularity and duration were stronger predictors. We controlled for a whole host of covariates, so age, sex, ethnicity, socioeconomics, and then some other really important ones like physical activity, smoking, alcohol, shift work, and also baseline physical and mental health. And finally, we also look to characterize the relationship between sleep regularity and sleep duration.
Fantastic. I will say I was really impressed with the rigor and attention to detail that your models included, the access to the various covariates here. I thought that was very prudent of you and laudable. So well done there. Generally, what did you find across the investigation?
We found that lower sleep regularity predicted higher premature mortality risk. That was sort of the first finding. So the most regular sleepers in the cohort had about a 30 to 48% lower risk of premature mortality compared to the least regular sleepers. So a fairly substantial difference between sort of the most and the least regular. And also across the range of SRI scores with incrementally higher sleep regularity, we observed incrementally lower mortality risk. For sleep duration, we observed a U-shaped relationship between sleep duration and mortality risk. So what that meant was that people getting approximately 7.5 hours of sleep were the people at the lowest risk of mortality in the cohort. And we also tested two different model comparison methods. And we found using those methods that sleep regularity was a stronger predictor of mortality risk than sleep duration across both of our model comparisons. And also for the cause-specific results, so we found that higher sleep regularity predicted lower risk of mortality by both cardiometabolic causes and cancer. In contrast, sleep duration was only predictive of mortality by cardiometabolic causes, but not mortality by cancer. And then finally, we found a weak nonlinear relationship between sleep regularity and sleep duration. So people with short or very, very long sleep also had less regular sleep, but it was a fairly weak correlation that we found there. Yeah.
As I was digging deeper into preparations for this, I learned that one of the major strengths of the Sleep Regularity Index, or SRI, is that it's supposed to be largely independent or poorly correlative with sleep duration. Is that correct, Andrew?
That is correct. In almost every data set we've looked at, there's a weak or no relationship with sleep duration.
Super cool. I'm very excited to hear more about this Sleep Regularity Index, or SRI. So great findings there. And ultimately, what's the message here? What are the big take-homes from this investigation?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest one is we need to be paying more attention for sleep regularity. If you think of how we deliver messages to the public, you know, in terms of guidelines around their sleep, you know, the focus has almost always been on sleep duration. You know, are you getting your quota of sleep for your age? And I think what we need to be doing is communicating more of a message around consistent timing, because it's not just this study, but a number of studies out in literature now showing that sleep regularity is very important for this. The other thing I do just want to say, though, is don't neglect sleep duration. I've had some people come and say to me after this, like, oh, great, so does that mean I could just sleep 4 hours consistently and I'll be fine? I'd really prefer you don't do that. You know, it's important to be serving both dimensions of sleep, both the consistency or regularity and the duration.
And that comes from the man who was trying to find a way to get rid of sleep back in the
exactly.
earlier days of life. Yes. So we heard it there.
You can trust me.
Beautiful. And I fully agree on that, right? Sleep health is multidimensional. And yes, some things may be stronger predictors, but that doesn't mean that it diminishes the import of the other domains as well. So I'm glad you put the emphasis there. All right. Well, I think that sets the stage for us to dive a little bit deeper into the empirical weeds. So we'll get our weed whackers out here. And I've got a couple questions to get us rolling. And I think what's critically important to really just spend some time unpacking this metric, the sleep regularity index, the SRI, which was a focal predictor in this investigation, capturing sleep irregularity. And truthfully, as much as I've done some actigraphy work, you know, I'll be transparent, candid here, I actually had never heard of it before this investigation, fully naive. So I'm excited to learn from the experts here about the SRI. What is the sleep regularity index? How is it created? Give me all the details. No, give us a digestible understanding of what this is.
Absolutely. Let me give you the high level. So it's not that surprising that you haven't heard of the sleep regularity index, or SRI, because it was only developed in 2017. It was a relatively recent addition to the literature. There are other metrics of regularity that go further back, you know, such as interdaily stability, which you're probably quite familiar with. When I developed the SRI, it was really to better understand what was happening on a circadian timescale. I was actually at the time supervising a student who wanted to look at irregular sleep patterns in college students. And we immediately realized two things. One was that there wasn't really a metric for comparing one day to the next. And one day to the next is important for the circadian system, right? Because that's how shocks happen to the system. The circadian clock likes regularity. It sort of expects each day to look like the previous day. And when that doesn't happen, that's a disruption to the system. You know, the system now has to adjust its phase, adjust its amplitude. And this obviously has shock waves throughout the entire network of oscillators throughout the body. So that was the first thing. It was that, you know, existing metrics weren't specifically looking at what was happening from one day to the next. That was part of the motivation. The second issue was that a lot of metrics were premised on the idea that you have one main sleep per day. And yet when we looked at college students, or when you look at shift workers, that assumption can break down pretty quickly. You can have students who pull all-nighters, or they have segmented sleep, or they nap during the day, and maybe they nap irregularly. So it becomes hard then to apply a lot of these metrics. So what I wanted to do then was develop a metric that satisfied those two kind of desirable characteristics. One, that it was comparing one day to the next. And two, that we weren't actually making any assumptions about what sleep looks like, whether there's a main sleep or not. And so the idea ultimately was just to compare the overlap. If I compare today to tomorrow, how much overlap is there in your sleep-wake pattern? If you're someone who sleeps at exactly the same times each day, the overlap would be perfect, and that would be an SRI of 100. Whereas if you were to sleep completely at random, there would be no correlation from one day to the next, and then that would correspond theoretically to an SRI of 0. In reality, we don't usually see SRIs all the way down to 0, but we do see low scores, like a score of 30, perhaps in a rotating shift worker. And so that was the basic idea of the metric. It was to sort of look at how much similarity is there from one day to the next as a proxy for what is happening to our circadian clock.
Makes sense. And just a very elegant description of what is very likely a much more complex algorithm and approach. So well done there. And I personally can see immediate application to my research when thinking about individuals experiencing excessive daytime sleepiness who have frequent napping patterns, and how this can be a much more useful tool relative to some of the other measures that we often apply. And maybe we'll talk more about the beneficial times to apply this and when others may be more beneficial, as I know you've done some work there as well and published some great work. But before getting into that, if people are interested in applying the SRI to their research, is this possible?
Yes,
we've tried to make that easy, and I'll let Dan speak to that.
Yes, I developed an R package called SleepReg, short for sleep regularity. The package can be used to calculate sleep regularity index scores from accelerometer data or other sleep-wake data. Primarily, it was designed with accelerometer data in mind, but there is an option there for people to put in their own sleep-wake data collected by whatever means they feel is an accurate representation of someone's actual sleep-wake patterns. Let's put it that way. So it was designed with actigraphy in mind, but you don't have to use actigraphy, is how I've got it set up at the moment. Yeah,
I love hearing that, because obviously there are some more novel approaches outside of the standard actigraphs that are starting to become more ubiquitous in not just the research space, but potentially the clinical domain these days. And thus, we're seeing potential extension, if you will, if it's just the ability to utilize more or less binary zeros and ones sleep and wake designations. And one of the limitations I've always found in a challenge with standard actigraphy is how to navigate the motionless wake situations. And I don't think the commercial devices these days have resolved that issue, but I think we're moving closer as we include other biosensors to potentially getting a better ability to wrangle in that problem. And so I see just that as a nice way to adaptively integrate these technologies that might be able to resolve kind of a major pitfall here. And I am curious, and we'll come to that probably later, how the SRI handles motionless wake. So I guess it would be the GGIR package, how it handles motionless wake, since it's just getting fed in the sleep wake staging. But we kind of approached it already, Andrew, and I'm just curious, you know, there are other ways to capture sleep regularity or irregularity. And Dorothy Fisher, Beth Clareman, as you've acknowledged already, and yourself, really put together an amazing, I actually had to share it over Twitter or X or whatever platform that is these days, article from 2021 in Sleep entitled Measuring Sleep Regularity, Theoretical Properties and Practical Uses of Existing Metrics. It was fantastic. A really nice primer at whatever level you wanted, from high level to more granular on these different techniques. So I guess just for the listener's sake, relative to other metrics, when is the SRI most recommended for use?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say, firstly, it's a metric for use when what you care about is circadian disruption, because that's specifically what it's trying to measure, what's changing from one 24-hour period to the next, which is something that many traditional metrics don't do. I think it's also a well-suited metric if you're working in a population with fragmented sleep or with multiple sleep episodes in one 24-hour period, because that can be overlooked by a number of other metrics. But there are certainly pros and cons to the sleep regularity index. The way I think of the sleep regularity index is as a composite measure of regularity. You know, it kind of captures all potential contributors to irregular sleep. So that could mean variability in your sleep onset time. It could mean variability in when you wake up. It could mean how fragmented is your sleep. It could also mean, are you someone who naps some days and not on others? So in that sense, it's a sensitive but relatively non-specific measure of sleep regularity. If you tell me you have a low SRI, I don't immediately know the reason for that. You know, I have to do a next level of investigation to understand, okay, well, what are the drivers of the irregular sleep? And if I want to design an intervention, then which dimensions should I be targeting? It's a pro and a con. It's probably why the SRI is relatively sensitive and correlates with many, many different health outcomes. But it also means that, you know, if we want some more insight, often it's useful to complement it with some other measure. For example, if we want to know specifically about sleep onset timing, then it's useful to look at variability and sleep onset timing alongside SRI. So that's sort of my take on it. I think it's both a strength and a weakness that it is this kind of composite metric of sleep regularity.
I love the way that's described. This global catch-all, a nice flag, if you will. And then if we want to have a more specific analysis, we can utilize a different technique that more principally targets that component of sleep regularity. I really like that description. And you kind of use the word limitation, and I opened it up earlier, and it's just something that everyone, I wouldn't say everyone, but is very commonly known now about a limitation of actigraphy in general, is just the vulnerability to motionless wake. So within the processing of these data, you know, using, I think it was like, what, 60,000 samples or so in the analytic data, 60,000 participants. Mm-hmm. How is motionless wake handled in the GGIR package? How is that attended to ensure that, you know, to the best of our ability, we're not going to be perfect here, but we're not looking at every data point, I would imagine. So how is that ensured or at least attended to?
So on one hand, you've got non-wear, so that's fairly easy to detect. So we can get rid of that in the first instance. And then the way GGIR handles sleep is it detects periods of sustained inactivity. So it looks for periods of greater than 5 minutes of a small deviation in the angle of the device. And it defines those throughout the entire recording. And then during the sleep period at night, it sort of defines like an onset and offset and everything within that that is sustained inactivity, it calls sleep. But it also defines sustained inactivity the exact same way outside of that sleep window. And so we've made use of that definition to approximate periods of sleep outside GGIR's defined single daily sleep window. And so it's sort of using the same methodology as it uses to define sleep during the night. We don't know during the sleep period at night whether you're having motionless wake or not. So the same likely applies for these consolidated periods of what appears to be sleep during the day as well.
I would agree with that. I think it's a universal issue, right? For any metric you're deriving from actigraphy, and we don't have a completely compelling fix to it at this point.
Yeah. And I come from the standpoint of right now, you know, we can live with this error because it is what is just inherent with the tools we have. We shouldn't be satisfied, but we shouldn't degrade scientific investigations because of an inherent limitation of the tool that we've all been leveraging for decades at this point. We should just be trying to progress the best we can and evolve with the times as well. And right now, we have what we have. So completely understand. And I think, you know, with the large scale data set, it makes total sense, right? And hopefully that error kind of gets washed out with the sample size as well. And Andrew, you gave like a very elegant description of the SRI, but clearly, you know, there's a lot more going into it. And we already talked a little bit about that it has a sensitivity benefit, but not necessarily a specificity, right? And there's a question that I guess came up in the editorial that was associated with your manuscript, or at least a comment. The editorial was titled, "Consistency is Key. Sleep regularity predicts all-cause mortality." And this is from the editorial where it says, "Another question stemming from this investigation is whether SRI is the most useful tool to capture interdaily regularity in sleep patterns. While the SRI provides a unique, valid, and reliable measure of sleep regularity that confers predictive value for health outcomes, the means of deriving this measure is complex and requires granular data on sleep and activity. In contrast, other measures of sleep variability, such as the intra-individual standard deviation of sleep onset timing, can be computed more easily." So I think we've danced around this a little bit and kind of touched upon it, but what are your thoughts on this commentary? Is this the most practical tool for researchers to use, for clinicians to use? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think it's a very valid comment. I mean, I think really that was what led us to want to release an open R package. The fact that we were hearing this consistently from other groups, they were saying, well, we want to use SRI, but how? And usually that would come down to us having to sort of guide them through it. And that clearly isn't scalable. And so the idea was to try to sort of put that in the hands of research groups where the calculation can be made quite easily. But I do agree. There are other measures that are potentially more easily computed. I think there are pros and cons to each of these approaches. As I said, there isn't a single optimal approach to this. And, I'm also not going to claim the SRI is the end of the discussion on computing sleep regularity. I mean, if someone comes up with a better alternative, then I'm very happy to use that as well.
Well, I do not accept that response, Andrew, because that is not provocative. And we are here to ruffle feathers. That's what we're here to do. No, I appreciate that stance. I mean, that's practical, logical. And I think you answered it. Dan answered it. It's an open source package now. So it is accessible. And I will say, go look at that GitHub page. The description provided there as far as implementation is extremely thorough, but also very easy to digest. So fantastic job there. And yeah, it relies on binary ones and zeros for data preparation. So it is very accessible from my understanding. We may not have to fully understand it for application. We just should understand when it's most applicable, I suppose.
I will say, in terms of what it's doing, there isn't actually that much under the hood. It really does come down to basically an overlap between one day and the next. There's some nuance around how missing data is handled, as there sort of has to be for any regularity metric. But it really is as simple as, does a zero match with a zero? Does a one match with a one from one day to the next?
Well, now the cat's out of the bag, and I'm not as impressed and intimidated by you. Well done. Good. Flagged this article and wanted to have a discussion around this topic. Is the importance for guiding future recommendations when it comes to public dissemination of knowledge, recommendations at the population level, things like that? Because naturally, sufficient sleep duration gets a ton of attention. But clearly, there's an emerging body of evidence that's really highlighting this importance of sleep regularity. And I just really liked what your team said in the manuscript, concluding with the following. Due to both psychosocial and biological reasons, extending sleep duration can be challenging to achieve in practice. Interventions to extend sleep that do not directly schedule when participants can sleep have only small effects on sleep duration. Asking people to maintain more similar sleep times between days to improve sleep regularity, rather than devoting a greater proportion of the day to sleep, may ultimately be a more feasible strategy. I really thought that was well written. So I do find it common, though, in the general population that people know sleep regularity is important. So for me, a couple questions come to mind. I first want to start with this. How do we help individuals? What are your thoughts on how we might be able to guide people to prioritize more regular sleep-wake patterns?
In general, I would say that there's not very much research at all on answering the question of how do we make someone sleep more regularly? How do we enhance sleep regularity? One potential factor could be an individual's attitudes towards sleep. So we actually ran a small-scale intervention study in uni students where we tried to improve their sleep regularity by providing them with information about the benefits of regular sleep, health benefits. An interesting finding out of that study was that we found that an individual's knowledge about the health benefits of sleep didn't associate with their sleep regularity, but their prioritization of sleep as a time commitment did. So in the same way that you would prioritize time for work, time for social activities, time for exercise, prioritizing time for sleep in your schedule will actually help you in maintaining more regular sleep patterns, as we found in our study. And the other thing I would say is light is very important. So pay really close attention to your patterns of light exposure. Really what you want to be doing is getting loads and loads of bright outdoor light during the day and stay in the dark during the evening and the night. Or if you can't stay in the dark, stay in an environment that's dimly lit with warm lighting, orange or red lighting. And this sort of enhancement of your circadian rhythms that you'll get by that pattern of light exposure will naturally enhance your drive to sleep at the same time each night. And hopefully the sleep regularity will sort of follow on from that light exposure pattern.
Yeah, beautifully said. And I recently had a post about this because I feel a bit defeated. At least in the United States here, people aren't happy. And There's a lot of data out there suggesting that people don't really like their jobs. And naturally, that's going to lead to a lot of bedtime aversion if you're not thrilled about getting up the next day to do the same thing that you didn't like doing that day, right? So I feel like that's a major uphill challenge here when trying to get people to have more regular sleep-wake habits, is just the fact that people aren't really thrilled with their day-to-day life. And that's just me at this point on the soapbox. But I do think ushering this information out there and amplifying the discussion in a manner that is digestible and understandable and attractive for the average individual in society is important. And it's really commonplace for someone in society to know that 7 to 9 hours of sleep duration is important, right? You sit down on an airplane, you tell somebody you're in sleep research or sleep medicine, and they're like, so 8 hours of sleep, right? Or they even know like 90 minutes as a REM cycle, right? These little clickbaity terms that have penetrated the common societal vocabulary. So you don't often hear like keeping variability within 1 hour or something like that come up as common speak. Do you have any thoughts on how we can make something more digestible that could be more integrated and implementable at the societal level?
Yeah, at least out of the data from this study, I think the message would be keep your bedtime and your wake time consistent to within about 60 minutes each day for better health and a longer life.
There you have it. Mic drop on that. Simple enough. You know, the 60-minute rule, right? And we can definitely get marketing on a way to spin that a little bit more, but I think that's simple enough. And it still affords you some error, so we're not putting so much pressure on you to go to bed at the exact same time every night, which can cause anxiety, worry, stress, and then be contradictory to sleep health. So I do love that kind of permission to not be perfect as well. And I think a key element here, and Andrew, thank you for kind of steering me to this important aspect of it in our discussions prior to this, is how do we best utilize this information to inform maybe regulatory agencies or whoever it may be to assist in providing guidelines or structure to aid the occupations that are most vulnerable to irregular sleep-wake schedules?
Yeah, I feel that we still understand shockingly little about this, you know, even in terms of what are the real drivers of irregular sleep. I mean, clearly, if someone has a shift work schedule, they're more likely to have irregular sleep patterns. But why do some individuals respond differently from others? You know, why are some people much more irregular than others? So, you know, I think there's a couple of sides to this. One is, how do we actually optimize or improve the work schedules themselves? And sleep regularity may be sort of another way of looking at that, you know, that hasn't been fully appreciated. Obviously, there are other dimensions of sleep, such as sufficient recovery time, sufficient time to get an adequate sleep duration, that are considered in shift work. But then, you know, the literature, when it gets into rotational schedules, it's actually quite nuanced. And it, you know, it's difficult to really come down with much of a clear judgment there, in my view. So that's one side to it. The other side is, well, maybe you can't do anything about the schedules. And that's going to be true in many industries. Are there still other things that you can do? And I think if we have a mechanistic understanding of this, then the answer is yes. And this really goes back for me to the circadian disruption aspect of irregular sleep. If irregular sleep is bad primarily because of circadian disruption that happens downstream from that, how can we target that? We may not be able necessarily to control when people work and sleep, but can we still control when they eat, or what is their pattern of light exposure? Other ways in which we might be able to buffer the effects of the irregular schedule that they're on.
Yeah, I love that approach. Making the best of a constrained situation by utilizing whatever tools we have available, whether that be meal timing, physical activity timing, the timing of everything, right? The Zeitgeibers, as you expressed. I look forward to that. And I think, you know, that requires a body of research. So I guess to both of you, given the findings from this investigation, your other investigations, where are you heading? Where do you think the field should be heading to progress this area of research?
think just in the first instance, we sort of need to better characterize the relationships between sleep regularity and various aspects of human health, just sort of at the large cohort epidemiological sort of scale. That's very much sort of growing area, but there's so many different outcomes that sort of should be looked at. Firstly, objective measures of sleep regularity and things like cancer, cardiometabolic health, mental health. There's like heaps of open questions about just basic relationships between sleep regularity and human health that I think we need to explore. So, and from you, Andrew?
Yeah, I think also we still need to better understand the causality of those relationships,
yes.
You know, which ultimately is going to come down to mechanistic or experimental studies. In other words, if we intervene in a certain way, do we see improvements in the long term?
Outstanding. Well, I can just tell you, nobody saw it, but my cat just intervened with our recording and just jumped on my lap. So I'll try and maintain steering our ship here, but I think he's telling me it's time for dinner soon. And I will inform him that we're closing down the interview soon. And I must thank both of you, Dr. Andrew Phillips and soon to be Dr. Dan Windred. Kudos to you, Dan, for making it through this somewhat argued traumatic experience, but it doesn't sound so traumatic for you. But cheers to you on that front. Thank you both for finding time to discuss this investigation, share your wisdom, and also showcase your awesome personalities. It's been a blast on my end. And also, the listeners may not actually know this, but the two of you patiently navigated a term we've used so far, a disruption in our recording, as my power actually went out about 20 minutes into our recording. So thank you so much for the patience on that front. But before I let you go and continue on with your workday, navigating your circadian dip, if you are afforded unlimited funding to explore a singular sleep and or circadian research topic, also no constraints, we could even throw out the IRB if you want, doesn't even have to be on this planet. We've heard people take it off the planet. So you're literally unconstrained here. I guess that's not true. It has to be related to sleep and or circadian research. There's that one constraint. Time's not even a factor. Then what would you investigate?
Wow, that's a big one. I'm going to stick with sleep regularity. And I think what I would really like to do is truly establish the causality on this one once and for all. So take a very large cohort of people and intervene, pay people, do whatever you need to do to keep them on a completely regular schedule for years, decades, and see what is the effect of that.
Beautiful. And Dan, how about yourself?
I'm going to go proper sci-fi with this one, or maybe not quite that far. In circadian research, everything is about the SCN, suprachiasmatic nucleus in the brain. It's our brain and body's clock, and it orchestrates all of our circadian rhythms. So what I want to do is I want to throw a whole bunch of money at directly recording the signal from the SCN. So implant a microarray of electrodes on the SCN, get real-time recordings of what the SCN is doing. And you could even take it one step further. You could use optogenetics. So you can make neurons light sensitive and you can effectively control individual neuron impulses. So we'll firstly record the SCN. Secondly, we will induce signals in the SCN to enhance people's circadian rhythms.
Maybe Elon Musk could support this.
Elon Musk.
You know, I'm not far away as I'm in the Bay Area currently. So I'll just walk down there, knock on his door and see what he thinks. But the two of you have been fantastic. I thank you so much for your time, your patience, personality, your vibrancy, your knowledge, your wisdom, everything. And all I ask is that you take care of yourselves and you enjoy your regular sleep-wake patterns.
Thank you. We've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks very much for having us. It's been great.
And that concludes this episode of the Sleep Research Society podcast. Thank you very much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions for content or ways to enhance the podcast, then please feel free to send an email to sleepresearchsocietypodcast@gmail.com. Again, that is sleepresearchsocietypodcast@gmail.com. Before officially closing down this episode, I would like to directly thank the leadership of the Sleep Research Society, as well as the board of directors for their support of this initiative. Additionally, I'd like to thank the Sleep Research Society Communications Committee for their efforts in the development and maintenance of this podcast. Also, I'd like to thank chronobiologist Dr. Rulof Hutt for graciously providing the podcast intro and outro music. Lastly, I'd like to thank the community of fantastic sleep and circadian researchers that comprise the Sleep Research Society, as well as all other listeners of this podcast. Thank you, and until next time, sleep well.